I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind. Understanding right in the Eightfold Path.
I'm going to start talking about, start with the traditional Buddhist method of implementation. All of you probably are familiar with it. It's called the Noble Eightfold Path. And it consists of right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right recollection. You can read mindfulness for that if you want. Right attention, right view, and right intention. Now, the first thing I want to, the first point I want to make here is a extended footnote on the word right. This is not right in the sense of right versus wrong. Randy made a comment earlier about being in trouble with Mercedes-Benz. It was exactly on this point, if I recall. many people, I won't say most, but many people approach the Eightfold Path. They see, take right speech, for instance, and they have the view that right speech is saying the right thing in the right way at the right time. Which brings to mind a quotation from Aristotle, which says, it's very easy to be angry with someone. It's very difficult to be angry with the right person at the right time, in the right way, for the right reason. This I find very interesting, because Aristotle's talking about bringing attention to your anger. You know, most of us, when we get angry with somebody, we just... And 9 times out of 10, the person that we're angry, actually angry with, isn't the one in front of us. It's somebody else. But this poor person is getting the brunt of it. So, my understanding of the Noble Eightfold Path, it has absolutely nothing to do with right versus wrong. And I think this is a childish way of approaching spiritual practice. Because if you're approaching it in terms of right versus wrong, then you have in you some idea of authority of what is right and what is wrong, and basically you're relating to that authority as a parent, which makes you a child, and off you are, off you go. It is how most people approach spiritual practice and religion. Nine. When we talk about right speech, right speech is when you are talking, your attention is active when you are talking. Now, you may say, how do you do that? Well, with speech, actually, it's one of the easier ones. And it's just extremely, it's extremely effective practice. You listen to the sound of your own voice as you're speaking, as if you are listening to another person. This has some very interesting results. A consultant studied with me many years ago. I gave him this practice. He called me up a week later, and the conversation went something like this. Ken, yeah? You know that practice about listening to the sound of your own voice as if it was another person? You know, this attention and speaking thing? Yeah. Yeah. I'm screwed. What do you mean? Well, I've been doing that when I've been talking with my clients. It's complete bullshit. The only thing I'm doing when I'm talking to my clients is persuading them to give me more business. I'm not helping them at all. I can't work anymore. I said, well, you might consider when you work of actually helping your clients rather than just persuading them. Yeah, I suppose you're right. All right. And I mean, this in the consulting world, this is extraordinarily prevalent, that everything you're doing is about maneuvering the client so they give you another piece of business. This is not right speech. It's also not right livelihood. And if you look at it in terms of the relationships we talked about at the beginning, it's not a shared aim relationship. You're looking purely for mutual benefit, but in the consultant's role, it's a shared aim. It's the client's welfare with that particular problem. So it was, in this particular case, just a few days of listening to himself, and he realized that he wasn't practicing what his profession actually was. I gave him a lot of credit for that recognition. Another person came in after this, and I asked her, well, how'd the exercise go? And she just looked at me and she went, she never shuts up. She just talks and talks. I don't know how anybody can stand listening to her. First time she'd heard herself. This is the practice of right speech. When we do this, we hear what we are saying, how we are saying it, and there's automatic adjustments. We immediately detect whether what we're saying is appropriate to the situation or not. And we don't have to clean up so many messes afterwards. The result of this kind of practice is that we will say what is true. We will say it in a way that it can be heard. Our speech is more than likely to be gentle. And so forth, which are the traditional characteristics of right speech. What we forget is that much of what we read about the characteristics that arise in practice are the results of the effort of practice, not what you try to do. I was very grateful for someone who wrote to me recently, connected with the Then and Now class, saying that after our discussion of the teacher-student relationship, she finally understood that the effort was not to emulate the teacher, but to learn from the teacher. I thought, oh, this is good. This is not about emulation. This is about learning how to be awake. And how that looks for you is the way that it looks for you, not for anybody else. So you don't try to copy people. You bring attention to how you move. That's right action. And if you bring attention to how you move, you're not going to knock over water bottles. It just doesn't happen. Because as soon as you touch the water bottle, you're aware of it, and your hand stops. And now you pick it up. Almost all accidents happen because one isn't paying attention at that moment. I won't say 100%, but probably somewhere between 95 and 99. Right livelihood is the same thing. We bring attention moment to moment, day to day, month to month, and so forth, to what we are doing to earning a living, for earning a living. And of course, this is can be absolutely devastating to your career, but it may save your life. Several years ago, as many of you know, I went on sabbatical. And there was a very simple reason. I didn't know what I was doing teaching at that point. So I stopped. And everybody was like, you can't do that. But a lot of people were angry with me because they'd come to rely on certain things. But and I could have gone on teaching quite easily, but it would have been acting. It wouldn't have been felt right or true, and I wouldn't have been in any sense awake at the process. I knew I would be living a lie if I went on, so I had to stop. So as I say, this can be devastating for your career, but it may save your life. So when I say bring attention to this, it means experiencing what is actually going on when you are doing these things. Experience what is going on in you when you are talking. Experience what is going on when you are moving. That's right action. Experience what is going on when you are working. And anybody see Michael Crichton? Yeah, the B-plus movie. But it's very much about a person who comes to the point where I can't do this anymore. And there are certain consequences to that. Actually, there are a couple of people. One of them, actually, is killed because he can't do it anymore. Buddhism is not interested in your career. It's no interest whatsoever. Quite interested in your life. So you may have to decide what's more important. The same thing with right effort. This is something I've had to wrestle with intensely myself. Because for various physical reasons, I'm not able to do what it says you're meant to do in all the books. And I tried for decades and just kept making myself ill, which varied from just being in pain to being really quite seriously incapacitated. I was kind of stubborn. I wouldn't stop until my head actually couldn't hit the wall anymore, because the wall was always there. Just long past after it was bloody, it was just not possible to hit the wall. So I had to learn a very, very different idea of what right effort actually means. And it's an exploration I heartily encourage each of you to explore. What does right effort mean for me? Because the synonym for effort in Buddhism is enthusiasm. And when you feel enthusiastic about something, you pour your energy into it, and you pour your energy into it in a good way. So it doesn't have any of this Victorian nose to the grindstone, stiff upper lip, grin and bear it quality. And so there's a very interesting exploration. What prevents me from being able to engage this activity with enthusiasm? That's a very, very interesting inquiry. Right recollection, right mindfulness. We're going to have to retire the word mindfulness. It's been hopelessly corrupted in English. But its meaning, its fundamental meaning, is to remember where you are and what you are doing. That's what mindfulness means. The word in Tibetan and Sanskrit and Pali all means to remember. I'm not sure where mindfulness came from English-wise, but it did. there are certain things that are, it's constructive and helpful to remember, and there are certain things that it is not constructive and not helpful to remember. Wallowing in the memory of things still done and done to others' harm and things that were done to you is not particularly constructive. It reinforces a whole bunch of tendencies, etc. So there's a way of practicing mindfulness or recollection which is beneficial. That's what right mindfulness is. Similarly with right attention. There are all kinds of ways one can move into states of attention, trance states, and so forth, bliss states, high energy states. Not all of them are helpful to waking up. Some of them are the antithesis of waking up. So what is the quality you experience when you're exercising attention? Same with view and intention. I want to say a word or two about intention here. In the Mahayana, we are have the Bodhisattva vow, which is the intention to wake up in order to help others wake up. That's putting it in plain English. Now, it's very powerful. It's very, very deep. When you take the Bodhisattva vow, you're not always aware, but basically you've taken the vow never to indulge your own confusion. And that's a different way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it or understanding it, it is the resolution to have that quality of wakefulness permeate every aspect of one's experience. Which means that you get to experience everything in all of the dark hidden corners that you have avoided shining a light on for the last quarter of a billion years. Sorry, the universe is 14 billion years old, so make that quarter of a trillion. One of the extraordinary qualities of the Bodhisattva vow, which Shantideva sings of in the Bodhicharyavatara, is that once this becomes stable in you, that is, that intention really sinks in, then everything you do, whether it's sleeping or eating or playing, is in service of waking up. Because since that intention has really come in, then everything you do is part of that. So when you're relaxing in order to be able to create the conditions so that you can be awake and help others to be awake. So this intention makes everything in your life, or imbues everything with your life with meaning and purpose. It's quite extraordinary that way. So this is one way that you can implement, is become very, very clear about your intention in your life and follow the principle of bringing attention into every aspect and every action of your life. One, which I skipped over, was a right view. Right view means, in terms of the way we've been talking, not to get lost in the world of materialism, but to remember the world that we actually experience. And what we tend to do over and over again, as some of you probably got to see from that little score thing that we did, is that most of the time we're lost in the world of materialism. We do not set about living our lives to create the conditions to experience well-being in the lives in the life that we actually experience, which are the thoughts, feelings, and sensations. And if we did that, we would live very, very differently, many of us. I think at this point it's good to go back and pick up the exercise that we did at the end. Raquel, you ready? I asked you three questions. What would you do if you knew you had exactly 1 year to live? Now, by all means, we can talk about what you would do, but I'm more interested in what is the difference between what you wrote down and what you're doing now? Catherine, microphone, please.
What came up for me is not that much would actually change because I have been changing my life a lot. But the idea of status would disappear altogether, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You would no longer be concerned with status.
Yes, no longer.
Okay. What would that be like?
Just so relaxing. And I just think of all the tension that comes from that and all of the...
Well, you know what the next question is.
No, what is it? I'm dying to hear.
What are you holding on to it for?
That's a very good question.
Okay. And you can take and work with that just as you wish. Okay. Because it causes you a lot of tension by the sound of it. Okay. So that would be appropriate to think, okay, what am I holding on to and why? Okay. Anybody else? Diane. Chuck always has the mic.
This probably would come as no surprise, but I'd quit my job.
You haven't done that yet?
No.
Diane happens to be extremely good at a job she doesn't like.
Well, it just takes away from doing other things.
Exactly.
So it's all consuming. It just takes time away from other things.
Yeah. What you really want to be doing with your life. Yep. Okay. Anybody else? Molly.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.